For those of you who don't know me, I am Mikhail Chester. I go by Mike. I'm a faculty member at ASU in the School of Sustainable Engineering and the Built Environment. And today I'm delighted to speak with my colleague, Professor Charles Redman, whom I have known and will refer to as Chuck. Chuck and I have known each other for about 10 years, but have worked closely for about 7 or so years, and I'm going to give a little bit of context there in a minute. And I thought it'd be really interesting to talk to Chuck today because last time I did the forum, I interviewed two infrastructure people, engineers, but one leadership person who is not an engineer. Although I think that person sort of thought kind of similarly about human organizational systems the way that I do. And I thought it'd be interesting to talk to Chuck because Chuck's background is anthropology. And Chuck, you have said a number of things to me over the past 5 or 6 years that have resonated. I'm gonna start with a story here in a minute about one in particular that, you know, make me realize that you think about not just infrastructure, but societies, urban systems from a very different perspective than I do. And that's obvious, but I'd like to sort of tease out a little bit of that perspective today. So with that, thanks for joining me, Chuck. Happy to have you here.
Thank you.
So let's jump in. So Chuck, you and I worked together on a project called the Urban Resilience to Extreme Sustainability Research Network. And we're still working on that for about 7 years, but over the years that I worked with you on that project, you know, we were sort of focused on questions around kind of infrastructure resilience, different cities across the Americas. And I sort of got close to you you know, I had a chance to sort of talk a lot about, you know, different ways of thinking. But I went away to LA for sabbatical 1 year. And in that year, unrelated to you, I hosted a conference. And the keynote speaker was Jared Diamond, whom I think you know well, and you and he have sort of some similar background. And, you know, I had lunch with Jared Diamond, the author of, you know, books like Collapse, and mentioned your name, and he said hi, you know, stuff like that. But I came back in December, and I don't know if you remember this, but we went to the convocation ceremony. We were lined up together, you and I, and I was sort of relaying this story to you. And I forget how we came to this point, but at one point, you know, you and I were talking about while we were in line, kind of, you know, in our gowns, waiting to go into like hood students sort of thing. The idea came up of permanence of infrastructure, maybe more broadly societies. So you said something to the effect of, you know, you're an engineer, you know, you're trained to think about systems as permanent. And sort of I extrapolated from there as you have this sort of perspective from your anthropology background, which I think is really interesting, that maybe there's less of permanence, that things come and go, whether it's a society, whether it's infrastructure, something like that. And I kind of want to start there because I think it's an interesting starting point, because I think a lot of the conversations that I have with people about topics related to infrastructure, sustainability, resilience, and so on are often rooted in these ideas of permanence, that it's never okay for something to disappear, to go away, right? But I wonder if that's how you think about things, and you know, maybe you can start there and maybe give us a little bit about your background as an anthropologist and maybe how that influences how you think about these ideas around societies, urban systems, infrastructure, resilience, and sustainability.
You've given me a lot to work with there, and I'll wander around and you may want to redirect me if I get too far off track. And I'll try to respond a little bit to this conversation we had and give you, my PhD in my early training was in anthropology, and I was chair of ASU's Anthro Department for 9 years. So I consider myself an anthropologist, but in these last 20 years, I've become the token social scientist on projects. And so what I represent may be a little more than anthropology, or at least my perspective on more than anthropology. And the interesting thing is, historically, that is, as I became involved in my profession, infrastructure was always important because I was an archaeologist and we dug up things and buildings and stuff, and that's how we learned about the past. But we saw it more as what I'll call epiphenomenal. And this may rub you, Mike, the wrong way, but what was going on is people were trying to solve problems. People were trying to derive subsistence, conquer their neighbors, whatever. And infrastructure was a solution to the challenge that they were facing. But it was the socially defined challenge that was really the dominant feature. And the infrastructure was, I wouldn't say permanent, but it was a response. And then it took on a life of its own that it continued to be there and to direct things. And so if I were asked to define infrastructure, at 10 or 20, well, 20 or years ago or so, I would say it was the framework within which behavior operates. That is, it's a structural set of elements in this view. And life goes on within them. And so they are tailored or designed in ways to facilitate life as we socially define it or individually define it. And only in the more recent years have I begun to think of infrastructure as having a dynamic of its own and of itself, that not only does it create path dependencies that go on over time, but it actually directs those paths in a more active way than I might have thought 10 or 15 years ago. And so we sort of started, and a symbol of that is in major projects, and we'll talk perhaps a little bit about those later, like the Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research Project. It's interdisciplinary. It has dozens of researchers involved in it. But the integrating conceptual framework is what we call SES, or social ecological systems. And they say social systems, life systems, ecological systems, their interaction, and all the things that spin off from that: policy, economics, technology, infrastructure. But they aren't in the title. A big, what I consider conceptual leap forward is when we started working together on this urban resilience project, is we explicitly acknowledged that SES was an inadequate way to determine and to understand the trajectory of societies. And we explicitly added technology or infrastructure to the sort of generating duality, became a generating triumvirate of things like that. That's sort of how I see it. What the other element that I've sort of taken on, and knowing people like you or Bruce Rittman or Matt Fraser or so forth, took on value that not only did you all deal with things different than I historically dealt with. As a social scientist, we might deal with political organization, we might deal with economic systems, we might deal with family structure or things like that. And you might deal with water and air and buildings and electricity and energy. But that's only a small part of the puzzle. And what I think we've tried to grapple with in our new project is whether we not only start from different physical studies, we have a different logic of inquiry, a different logic of what knowledge is, or not. Maybe we don't have a different one. I oversimplify and think we do. And I, you know, think that ecologists seek a perfect world in which nature is the model. Social scientists feel the world's broken and it needs to be fixed. I can oversimplify and say, as an engineer, you think of ways to optimize the performance of the world given a certain set of expectations or requirements or something like that, that we each have a different set of values that we're bringing to the picture. Even if we've worked together with each other, we may see the world through a meaningfully different lens, making the addition of each other more valuable than just the addition of subject matter that we're adding on to each other. We're also saying we're looking at this world a little bit differently from each other. And that, in a way, gives us a more comprehensive, potentially useful picture of the world as it is today and the world we hope to make it. I don't know if I should keep going or let you jump in a little bit and react, because these are big things.
Thank you. So I want to come back to this idea, you know, of transdisciplinarity in a second here, because I think you've been at the center of that, of many of the big things that I am familiar with, particularly at ASU, but even more broadly. So I purposefully did not introduce you with the standard bio, because, you know, I think that's a little boring, but you know, I'm hoping to do something a little bit different here. So now that you've given us that perspective, can you maybe talk, you know, in summary about your path as an academic, as a researcher? And I want to qualify this. I did review your CV, and I actually went through your 50 years of publications of yours. And, you know, it's around 1970 or so, 71.
Yeah, 70 is my first real publication.
Yeah, when you first start publishing. And actually, one of your first ones is in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on Beginnings of Village Farming Communities in Southeast Turkey. And by the 2000s, you're maybe even 2010s or so, you're starting to make this transition into the topics that you just mentioned, you know, thinking about kind of urban systems, socio-ecological systems, you know, more the social science aspects as it relates to kind of the newer sustainability and resilience questions that we started asking. And then, of course, in the past 5 or 6 years, I know that you've been thinking critically about resilience, climate adaptation, right, those sorts of things. You've been department chair of, you know, you mentioned anthropology, which, you know, we call it something different at ASU, but founding director of the ASU School of Sustainability, which is, you know, our interdisciplinary school, excuse me. Can you just talk about this path? Like, how did you end up on this trajectory? So, like, you know, the way I'm interpreting it, you've got a solid, you know, 30 years, 35 years of doing hardcore anthropology. And then you seem to have shifted. So what happened? Am I interpreting that correctly?
No, that's good. And I actually do enjoy talking about it, particularly with graduate students or even undergraduates who are just formulating their viewpoints on career trajectories and things like that. And my trajectory in a way is absolutely logical and absolutely illogical. And so it does call for some explanation. I started out as an undergraduate thinking I was going to be an engineer. And by the time I started taking engineering courses, I knew that wasn't in my future. And it really was a toss-up what I went to graduate school in, but I went in archaeology, anthropological archaeology was what I ultimately went to graduate school in and what I started my career in. And it was great fun. And I was interested in the early civilization in the Middle East mainly, and early farming villages, as you mentioned, and eventually early cities in Mesopotamia and North Africa. I love archaeology. It's a huge intellectual challenge. You actually find things that haven't been seen by people for hundreds or thousands of years. You piece together these puzzles into something meaningful, and you have the freedom to say really grandiose things about the past and the future and all that. And so I actually do love it dearly. And it worked out well for me. I got grants and had projects and wrote books and things like that. I became chair of anthropology here, partly because the chair at that time became a dean and we were sort of left wandering. And so I stepped up and became it. It's not that I really wanted to be a chair. That worked out well. The department flourished. Anthropology in Arizona is sort of more important than it usually is because of Native Americans and the archaeology and so forth. And so it worked out well. And I, as chair, I thought I got along great with the dean and so forth. But then there was an episode where I found out the dean had called a meeting of five or six department chairs to figure out sort of the next step for the college. And I wasn't invited. And he liked me. You know, we got along great. And the anthropology was great. But the message was, as well as you do, it's just interesting. It's not the future of the university. Now, we could argue about that. But that was a sort of a wake-up call more generally in saying, what I'm doing is great. It gets published. I get grants. I find it fascinating. We have graduate students. But it's a long shot to say we're making the world a better place. I would say that, but it's sort of hard to say. And so I really had a sort of revelation, wake-up experience to say, if I want to have an impact on making the world a better place to live, I'm going to have to think this through a little bit more. And the first step of that was to become more involved in lessons from the past. And coincidentally, a colleague of mine from Rice University invited me to give a talk at a colloquium on climate change that was just beginning to be thought of more seriously as about early 70s. And so I began to look at what lessons I could learn from archaeology about how people adjusted, what did they do to their environment? Did they degrade it? How did they cope with the end of the Pleistocene, the changing environment then? And it became pretty interesting. And then I ultimately wrote a book about it called Human Impacts in Ancient Environments. While I was writing it, I met Jared Diamond, who was thinking about similar things that would ultimately become his Collapse book. And this became very interesting and exciting to me. And I had been chair of anthropology long enough. And there was a vacancy at our Center for Environmental Studies that I raised my hand for, and someone picked me. And so there, explicitly, everyone knew I was an archaeologist dealing with the past, but they also knew that wasn't what this center was going to be about. So I had separate funding for continuing as an archaeologist, yet I was going to focus on promoting contemporary and future-looking studies at ASU with my knowledge perspective, but not probably in my field at all. But there's a certain logic to the fact if you're trying to do an interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary project, that your own focus may not be the one you want to promote too hard. It becomes too much of a personal model. And too often in a lot of these studies, centers and labs become the legacy of an individual instead of a new comprehensive consortium of collaborating scientists. So this actually worked out quite well. And so our first big project was a long-term ecological research project that had a couple paragraphs about history and archaeology in the proposal. But in reality, it was 5% of a 95% balance of other things. And this was a step out, and this began to work. And so my own interests, which had been in the beginning of cities and agriculture, moved to the condition of cities and agriculture from a historical perspective, moved to the condition of cities and society from today looking forward. And this has been an evolution over the past 15 years or so, because really the LTR started in 1997 and my archaeology continued. And in fact, I'm invited to mainly my graduate students to talk about archaeology in the context of sustainability currently as well. But really starting in about 2000, my energy was really focused in today and in the future. And in what at that time we thought of as first sort of environmental studies, and quite happily became switched to sustainability studies then with the beginning of our school in 2006. I'm still not a academic expert on a lot of the things the projects I direct run, but I do feel that my background has been useful in terms of getting people to work together without having to get them to think the way I think, because I know that my unique expertise is different from what we're looking for. But my sort of long-term perspective is something that is gets valued as we start to put together ideas and things like that. So that's so, where so it
Chuck,
is.
Yeah. Well, so can I go a little bit deeper on that? So yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that I've noticed that's pretty interesting. A lot of the things that you've left your mark on, whether it's the School of Sustainability, Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research, CAPLTR, which if I'm not mistaken, is the first urban long-term ecological research program in the country. Obviously, the project you and I have worked on, Urban Resilience to Extreme Sustainability Research Network. These are, to the point that you made, like one of the things that I've noticed is these seem to be efforts, programs, endeavors that have created space for transdisciplinarity. And I don't want to use that word vacuously, but you know, you've sort of created these cultures where people of different backgrounds can come together, can think greater than the value of the sum of the parts, and go off, leave, you know, the university, go elsewhere. And there are these cohorts now that are out there, right? So like, you know, when I think about our work together, right, there's like this group of people out there now that think about like path dependency and safe to fail and these like, you know, resilience concepts that, you know, we've been working on as a team for only like 5 or 6 or 10 years in earnest, that now are, you know, faculty members at other places and are teaching it, right? And I think that's pretty unique. I think that's pretty amazing. Was that intentional? Was that sort of intentional in the design of those programs? Or was it just sort of in the way that you and colleagues approached how you manage it or you sort of strategically set it up?
Well, I don't have a direct or simple, complete answer, but I'll sort of reflect on a couple of issues I think are important here. I won't claim it as a special credit, but I do think that even starting early with the LTR and the beginning of the Center for Environmental Studies is that that I was open to a variety of ideas and perspectives, that because it wasn't my specialty, I didn't already have the paradigm and the framework that had to be pursued by the project, but I was open to the idea that we don't even know where the answers are yet, so we better make the umbrella really large to fit all sorts of ideas under it, and then we'll see which ones really work. I think that's true. That was particularly important in founding the School of Sustainability, because there's a real pressure with creating this first model that maybe we should put it in ecology or life science, maybe we should put it in political science or economics, put it in engineering or in architecture. And my response, and I think was supported by lots of the faculty, was that we're going to not define it in any of those fields at the outset, but see how they all work and see if there is a better solution than the one we can imagine today, because we've allowed people who focus on religious studies or Spanish language or unexpected areas of expertise may come to the table and bring things that we hadn't thought about. The other thing that I've been really lucky about, which is a little bit different issue, is I've been situated where female scholars were able to step ahead quite quickly. And so you have the LTR with Nancy Grimm, who's one of the great ASU researchers and scholars, still underappreciated at that time. Yet she really knew what she was doing and really was driven. And opening up the space, and what happened with her and then subsequently in the Decision Center for the Desert City with Pat Gober, in both of these cases, I co-directed the initial grants, but it was agreed that I would sort of do the battle with the local issues of the university and the administration and human resources and things like that to make sure the project ran and could manage it. And they would be the front face for the National Science Foundation, for the collegial networks. And that they were great and are great and moved them ahead quickly, but really moved the project forward, I think, faster than it would have been otherwise. Because quite frankly, and this is oriented at female graduate students listening, and I assume there are some, You're underappreciated for what you can provide to the endeavor. And I think that opportunity opened up for people has really made a difference. And it made a difference for me because I get all sorts of spin-off credit for doing things that I'm not really doing, but whatever, I'm holding it up together and just opening the space for not only the diversity of thinking on it, but a diversity in terms of gender expertise and so forth.
Great, thank you. So let's, I want to sort of spin back now to kind of infrastructure, cities, and so on, and kind of dig into some issues there. So, you know, I think an important place to start when we talk about this is sort of getting your perspective on complexity. You know, when we use a word like that, when we think about complexity, like what is it that you are thinking of? Because I often find that we're not on the same page when we talk about that, or there might even just be disagreement, right? Some people think complexity is increasing, so to speak. Some think it's just always been there and will always be, and, you know, we'll figure it out, that sort of thing. So, you know, when you think about complexity, do you think about, you know, are we experiencing increasing complexity, more complex conditions? You know, if not, why?
I'm gonna grapple with this maybe in a slightly different way. When I take a sort of long-term perspective on trying to explain grandiose things and inadequately, but try to anyway, I look at sort of the evolution of three different sort of human innovations or human approaches to solving great problems. And one of them is mobility. And I look at this through history, through the long-term perspective, that moving, people moving around solves lots of different problems, that mobility can be within a geographic place, but it also can be between geographic places. And a great deal of power goes from it, and a great deal of the nature of society, and we're up against it today in all sorts of ways, is how do we lock down mobility, or how do we allow it freely to move about, both of goods, services, people, knowledge, all these things. The second, I think, is one of the great human distinguishing features, and that's management of ecosystems, management of human organization, management of other people, that we have historically and contemporaneously moved ahead and solved challenges mainly by bringing the context within our domains of problem solving. And this is where I get back to infrastructure being a way to solve problems. And maybe a lot of the early infrastructure in the world was a response to spreading irrigation water or defending cities or building Roman highways or whatever they were. But they enabled a kind of social advance that wouldn't have been possible without them. The third force I see historically is complexity, and that's where I'm getting back to you. But it's as a verb, not as a noun. It's complexification. And this is a tough one because I'm not sure I really am settled on what impact it has. But I think historically we can see lots of complexification occurring. Number one, as a problem solver, but also giving value to the ensuing society in itself. And so is a more complex society a more effective society? I mean, Occam's razor tells us go the other way. Let's make things simple to get the same result. And then I'm saying, well, maybe the more complex the situation is, the more powerful and adaptive it is. I'm not sure I know my own answer on this question, but I know both the noun complexity that exists, or adjective, or whatever we want to say, is important, but also the act of doing it straightens things out. And when one has to look, or at least if you take the historical perspective like I do, and say, in how many situations has a simpler fill-in-the-blank government structure, economic structure, triumphed over a more complex structure? And I think we could argue that there are cases where that's happened, but the numbers are small compared to social change and whatever we're calling progress. being in response to an increasing complexity or social complexity, class structure, interaction, the internet, you know, globalization, all sorts of things you could talk about today. So it's a central theme for me to be thinking about, to know just where it's leading us and whether I want to say, well, complexity is good or it's bad. I'm not ready to take either of those positions yet, but complexity is an essential component of whatever we're doing.
I appreciate that. There's, you know, as I've read about this topic, right, there's like the kind of Jared Diamond perspective that, you know, environmentally, societies become so complex in how they use the environment around them that they, you know, can't handle it and they collapse, right? There's the Joseph Tainter that, you know, societies become so complex that they collapse. There's I forget his name, what's his name, the bureaucratic guy from a century ago, you know, he talks about bureaucracies becoming so complex that societies collapse. And, you know, I appreciate you saying you're not sure where you land on it quite yet, instead of the sort of fatalistic viewpoint.
Well, you know, in each of those cases, and I'm going to hearken back to one of the things Jared Diamond says. He sees social complexity, particularly when it leads to inflexibility. And this is a big part in both Joe Tainter and Jared Diamond, is the complexity in an inflexible bureaucratic organization could mean the death knell. One thing that Jared said that I find really interesting and parallel something Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, has said, is the key issue is in change, social change or whatever it is. It's important to know what of the structure to maintain and what of the structure to leave behind. And the argument would be that there are probably really important essential elements of this complexity that allow us to achieve our goals. And then there are things, I'll use the word epiphenomenal again, things that maybe are there and we see a lot, but may not be essential to the operation of the activity or not. And so, and the Thomas Friedman book is The Lexus and the Olive Tree, which talks about globalization leading to all sorts of things that societies across the world value and see, versus things that are really important on the local front, that you cultural heritages, the olive tree is his example, versus the Lexus everyone wants to have, but the olive tree is only important to certain societies, but very important. And so the idea would be, what do we hold on to and what do we give up? And then complexity takes on a slightly different term, where in, you know, leading to inflexibility in a variety of other, you know, top heavy, overhead heavy societies, it's easy to see why they would collapse.
So, you know, you and I have been neck deep in like the resilience world for the past, you know, however long, 5, 10 plus years. And I think together we've often poured through kind of framings of resilience. And, you know, I still love your 2014 paper, Should Sustainability and Resilience Be Combined or Remain Distinct Pursuits, sort of trying to make sense of these two forces, for lack of better words, right? You know, that have been moving fairly quickly, and, you know, a lot of us have been sort of aligning ourselves around them. But more and more, as I work in the resilience world, I think of resilience, particularly having manifested in its current form, the way that we often talk about it today, as something that seems to be in response to what I would argue is complexity that has accelerated or emerged in particular forms, whether it's climate change, climate adaptation, or
April 20th.
Cyber technologies, sort of rapidly accelerating, integrating, you know, cybersecurity, cyber vulnerability issues, and so on, right? So, you know, I almost view resilience as a mechanism in its sort of current form to respond to that complexity. Do you think that's reasonable? Would you disagree with that? Think otherwise?
Well, I definitely like the idea of thinking of resilience as a as an active element, as a verb, as doing something, responding to something, being able to cope with it. I think the issue for me about resilience is it implicitly means to me flexibility, and implicitly means to me a capacity to adapt as well as the actual adaptation itself, but it's this ability to respond effectively. The problem for me is that it's not sure that all resilient things are good, that you may find really these strongly adaptive ways, and I know we agree with this, each other on this, but that you may find something that's really helps society continue or grow or do whatever you've defined as your objective, but it's really ugly and it may take the form of the continued warfare. I mean, you know, for some people, wars are really okay. I'd like that to change that picture a little. The poverty trap, you know, the health, education, social impacts of poverty are so reaffirming that it's really hard for people to escape from it once they're caught in this conundrum. But it's so in a way, poverty, warfare, autocratic fascist government, these things are all very resilient. And so for me, the element of resilience I want to add into the adaptive flexible notion is, how do we unseat resilient things? And how do we add a sense of value into resilience? And that's where I think sustainability can come in. But I think on its own, resilience, I mean, the world in a lot of measures is really doing okay. You know, there's more people, they live longer, they have fewer toothaches. You know, there's a whole variety of measures where the world has been very successful. And you say, but it's doing terrible things to so many people. And so we need to, the big challenge facing me, or I believe from my opinion facing the world, is how do we find things or define things that are currently resilient, but leading us in pathways that work out, but work out for a world that we really don't want to value or promote. And so I need the resilience, both how do we enhance the capacity to do it, but to do it in a way that leads to the results and outcomes that we want. And inherent in at least Buzz Hollins's resilience theory is up in advance, you don't decide whether it's good or bad. Resilience is an outcome. It's a self-emergent property of a system. And that emergent property may, in fact, lead a lot of people in that system to be in suffering situations instead of in all productive. And we need to straighten that all out. That's a big challenge for us.
So you use the word technology, you know, in the context of infrastructure, maybe even more broadly. But, you know, I want to kind of get your some additional thoughts here going on the word technology. Like, how do you think about technology? You know, even when we talk about infrastructure, are they synonymous? Like, you know, what is it that you think about there? And then do you think about technology as a destabilizer, a stabilizer? You know, how do you approach a question like that?
Well, just as I'm willing to welcome people under the umbrella of a project to get a better, more comprehensive approach to it, I'm willing to be pretty loose in my definition of terms. And so I might be hard pressed to put a boundary around technology in particular. Infrastructure, I haven't tried to put a definition on it, but I can see infrastructure being gray and hard and roads and power lines and things like that. But it's also the organizational structure that populates the material world of infrastructure. And that is part of it. And then maybe if I had to define these terms, I would say technology is the container within both the hard and the organizational and the aspirational elements of infrastructure all together go together to become a technology. And maybe a guidebook to how it operates and all. I mean, there may be a whole variety of elements. And I think I see technology as the broader term, but I'm not willing to put too many boundaries on infrastructure either, because I think it's useful to us to look at it broadly, because if we looked at it just as the canal itself or the roadway or the power line or even the power generating station as well as the power line, then we're not looking at what really drives it. And so I'm happy to think of it as both a social system as well as a hard system, well as a managerial system and things like that.
Well, maybe let me push sort of a different angle here. When we frame technology as, let's say, for example, the kind of rapid or the acceleration of cyber technology, digital kind of integration of digital into kind of legacy non-digital systems, you know, things like that, which, you know, I think by every measure is accelerating kind of exponentially, right? You hear things like, we produce more knowledge or information about the world in a year than we have over, you know, millennia in the past, right? Or centuries in the past, stuff like that. Do you think that a technology like that is sort of a unique and potentially new paradigm for the planet that we haven't experienced? Like, how do you see, I'm wondering kind of like as an anthropologist, like how you see something like that, is this a new force that's never been paralleled, or do you think this is just change as usual?
Well, I'll take a little bit of a historical viewpoint first, and then I'll try to grapple with the present. I think there have been transformatory scale technological innovations in the past. And the immediate thing I think of, because I go way back, is something like the wheel. And the wheel is a solution to a series of problems, but it enabled a variety of physical activities, which enabled a whole new variety of organizational activities. And then I think of writing as a system of knowledge and communication. And writing had fundamental impact on the way we conducted life after that and on the possibility, potential. And it not only allowed you to communicate over distance, but it solidified communication from a verbal form to a more permanent form, which led to a different level of trust and a different level of commitment. And contracts take on a whole different view when they're written versus verbal, things like that. So I think there are things that have happened, technological innovations that, you know, were in some way invented, even if it may have taken a little while to take them into full force, but that just changed the whole way the world operated. Now, we continue to argue in, you know, the Industrial Revolution and then, you know, the internal combustion engine. And, you know, you might think of other things, the typewriter or the printing press or whatever going forward. I think we have a lot of those. I think for me, the biggest question or the biggest lesson is that I fear we do a lot of things because we can do them rather than we should do them. And I just was involved in sort of evaluating a program about gene counseling, DNA counseling for people, and should we, and ASU is going to give degrees in it. Don't worry about it. We're stepping in there because there's a need for this and there's demonstrable job opportunities. And I look at that and I say, is that a technology that we're doing because we can do it scientifically? Or is it one because the world will be a better place because we do it? And I'm not convinced of that, by the way. And it takes a different spin on in a way, the guiding character of technological innovation is that it opens up new avenues that people may want to move down, but they may want to move down it for a variety of reasons that may or may not be what I consider making the world a better place and individuals better off for it. Or it may be, you know, there's lots of good sides to, you know, DNA counseling and I'm not sure what they are, but there are good sites and in terms of guiding things, and people want to know and so forth and so on. But also it creates a tool that scares the heck out of me. Just as many other of our new innovations in terms of tracking people and privacy issues. And, you know, the whole notion of smart cities makes a lot of sense at some level, but it also introduces a city that I'm not sure I want to live in. There's a lot going on. I think technology's daily changing the world. And then the question is, are we paying attention?
So let me pick up there. Where do we go? You know, so you've now been at the forefront of, you know, kind of sustainability research, sustainability and resilience research in many ways. You've been on a number of cutting edge projects, training, and so on. And if I were to ask you, what are the next grand challenges for kind of infrastructure, cities, societies, as we think about sustainability and resilience? What are we missing? Where should we be focused going forward? What would your answer be?
I see a number of fundamental conundrums or challenges that if we could effectively address, could give us a better roadmap to where we could be going. And so, you know, I think some of these are inherent conflicts like efficiency and flexibility. That is, a lot of evidence, if you buy stocks and so forth, companies that work on, you know, immediate same day delivery, just in time inventories, all sorts of things have been very successful in the world. However, you know, when you have a breakdown in the supply chain, you've got a huge problem then, because you have no inventory because you're waiting for it to arrive. And so you have this problem of being efficient and doing what you want to do, but does hyper efficiency eliminate alternatives and eliminate redundancy and eliminate backups that all are important during times of catastrophe or trouble or interruption or whatever? And so this balance between efficiency and flexibility, I think, is a fundamental conundrum we have to solve somehow. My own personal one, having started out as an archaeologist, is the idea of most decisions are made on a short-term maximization platform. But how does that interact with sort of the long-term good of the organization or society? That is, they're cast in different ways. And I come from the side that says, well, you really have to pay attention to these long-term impacts and what you're really doing to the broader picture. But I also recognize that if you don't succeed in the short term, your organization may be outcompeted and you may no longer be there. And that could be either a human organization or a company or whatever. And so we need to somehow work together so that we make short-term decisions that allow us to succeed, but they also open up doorways that allow us long-term to be successful in whatever defining ways we do that. And so that's sort of number two. I tell classes that they're Nobel laureate nominees if they can solve these things. And the third is a straightforward one, is we talk in sustainability and environmental issues about the long-term costs of not being prepared. If we don't take this into account, you know, this will lead to catastrophes in the future. And that's the favorite thing we're saying about climate change. But how do we take those long-term costs and convert them into present-day dollars so that people are willing to do that? You know, what is the investment? Economists tell us don't bother. Economists will tell you, and I'm oversimplifying, that if it's out in the future, 50 years or something, it's worthless today. Don't worry about it. You know, you'll take care of it as you get closer to it. You know, don't worry about those long-term things because they have no present-day dollar value. They do. Somehow they do. I'm sure of it. Because of the path dependency, and once we get caught in a direction, we don't get out of that direction, even though the time may approach. And so how do we convert that? Insurance companies have found a way to do that. Why haven't we done that with climate change yet? Any number of people will argue about the enormous human and economic costs of climate change in the future. Yet, how many people have said, well, you know, but to save that $1 trillion, let's spend it today. We're fighting that right now. And so I think there's a whole series of conundrums that need to be solved. And I'd add to that Jared Diamond's one of what change in terms of transformational change, what do we hold on to and what do we give up? And knowing which will be of the long-term value to maintain the identity and function and values in society would be a pretty good thing to be able to do. I'll give you one thing that I just came up with this week, or I didn't come up with it. I read it. Actually, my son sent me something they had written. If we were designing an infrastructure for the future, if we were making decisions about what is worth doing and not doing, we could have a variable of what does a 1.5 degree centigrade lifestyle demand. You know, that could be the mantra of going forward with this is worth doing, this is, you know, once you get into values, everyone has different values and logically, and that's not bad, but it makes it hard to make value decisions. We could make a climate change threshold value that maybe we could have uniformly applied. And it would be, this is worth doing if it lets people live within 1.5. This needs to be avoided if it's going to enforce people living in a way that the 1.5 degree world will be exceeded. That's probably my biggest sort of thing I would throw out today to say we need to get some momentum on.
Chuck, thank you. Appreciate the perspective, and we'll end on that thought.
Now you have to define what the 1.5 degree centigrade lifestyle world is. What does it look like? But that's what people need to do then.
Yeah, given the inequities of how we live across the planet today, you know, which end of the, you know, livability spectrum are we at, right?
Yeah, a lot of people are living within it, not by choice.
Yeah. Yep. Let's open it up to Q&A, and I don't see any questions in right now, but I'll give folks a minute to type anything they want to ask Chuck in the Q&A feature at the bottom there.
While people are doing it, I'll give you one other big picture thing that I think about. I don't know how to operationalize, but I think it's life-changing. And by the way, I think lots of things that we ought to be doing are really hard because social transformation or societal transformation is a risky endeavor because we're not sure of outcomes and people are unwilling to take the chance. And taking true and tried paths often don't lead us far enough. Okay. My transformatory thought for the day is we value enhancing productivity. Often we say this nation's productivity is going up and isn't this great? And this company's productivity is increasing and isn't this the way we want it to do? And unproductive countries. But the way we measure productivity is product output or whatever the value we're looking for per labor input. And what it often leads to is we're able to get increased product output per labor hour or day or whatever by increasing the energy use and increasing the material input. And so it leads to a world where for the same amount of goods, you need fewer people and more energy and more material. Our future is a world where people are increasing and energy and materials should be conserved. It's sort of an upside down to the normal productivity cycle. We should be producing goods that take more hours, more labor, less energy, less material. It sounds like sort of quality production, craft goods. You know, should we be transforming a world where commodities are not the exchange medium, but sort of quality craft goods are that take more time, but use less energy and material, last longer, maybe more set. I don't know. It's a turning one of the fundamental measures of the world upside down for the future.
mean, I think COVID has been a nice opportunity to turn upside down the idea of normative, right? I think COVID has shocked us in many different ways. And one of those ways is, you know, I think in mentally, right? I think it's sort of getting us to rethink how it is that we are doing things, why it is that we're doing things. Do we need things as quickly as we do, right? And I think in some ways, I'm hopeful that we come out of this with at least some fraction of human behavior and human, you know, endeavors saying, I think we can continue to do things a little bit differently as COVID showed us, and everything's going to be okay, right? Reframing what was normal. I'm worried the evidence is suggesting the other direction. We're just bouncing right back to where we are were before. But like, I'm in no rush to jump back on like the airplane rewards program rat race of, you know, like, how do I get status as quick, you know, and maintain status and things like that. I'm more than happy, you know, not playing that game and, you know, having a little bit of breathing room on the ground, maybe just virtually.
I think it's opened the door to reevaluate a lot of local versus long distance activity, a lot of household based activity. I think that's opened the door. You're right. How it'll ultimately play out, I don't know either. But I do think some things won't return to the same. I think it's been a shot in the arm for Amazon, though. I think if we ever questioned whether deliveries was going to be the way we buy goods in the world, they've taken quite a step forward during the pandemic.
Yeah, and to the points that you made earlier, right, we've thought about this a lot, right? How is it that Amazon was able to scale up so quickly, right? Whether we call that flexibility or something else, whereas other industries were not able to scale up or down as quickly to meet rapid shocks, rapid changes in supplier demand, right? And I think that's part of the nature of, you know, I forget the words that you use, sort of, you know, efficiency versus resilience or something, you know, something else of how we design our systems, whether we're more towards one end of the spectrum or the other. So a question from the audience. Thanks for the great conversation. Being a space maker for interdisciplinary research, I was wondering if there was a moment that stands out to you as to when you realized your own biases and how you began to actively navigate them.
That's a question I need to think about a little bit. It isn't one of those common ones I'm asked. I think probably one of the areas, and this it's a good question, because too infrequently do we worry about how we ourselves influence how everyone else acts and does things and limits people and whatever we want to do. I think probably I was thinking of a couple situations, but one of them would be in creating the School for Sustainability. There became a huge conundrum over how much we train people with specific outputs that would allow them to get a job versus how much we step back and say, these are more sort of fundamental ways to do things. And it became a serious argument in people wanting, when they get a degree, they want to have a skill that's usable and they want to be able to do the math or to figure out the formulas or do the measurements that are needed for people to move forward for zero waste or for greenhouse gas reduction or goals that are widely agreed upon and needed. And how much do we actually train how to do it or not? And I have to say that in the 12 years of the school existing, or whatever it's been, I guess 14 years now, we've gone up and back on that a lot. And my own view was to keep it more general, but there was a lot of pressure to really have outcomes, measurable outcomes. And we've got these things now that we try to have project learning outcomes and things like that. Some of them are quite specific, some are more general. But that debate And it was a debate with the students. I mean, the students were probably more driven because they looked at their career and in a year or two, they wanted to be able to come out and get a job doing sustainability. And they said, what does it take? And then when they went to an employer, they said, well, do GIS, do greenhouse gas reduction, you know, do a variety of things that required a mathematical training. And we weren't requiring that. And there was a wide distribution among the graduate students, in particular, between those who had really strong mathematical training and those who had avoided it almost totally in their careers. And yet we were giving the same degree, and that sort of space was a hard one to navigate and continues to be a one that's actively debated.
Chuck, earlier you mentioned, I think it was in reference to the CAPLTR project, the idea of kind of leadership, and I'm sort of synthesizing or summarizing here, leadership around research and kind of intellectual development of ideas, and leadership around administration, bureaucracy, right? Those sorts of things, right? And on a big project, well, let's start with a small project. On a small project, generally like one person or maybe two are doing both, right? And you just don't have the resources or the need to do anything different. But when you get into larger projects, one of the things that I've noticed with the work that you've been involved with is that there seems to be this model, and maybe I'm oversimplifying and disagree with him, but this model of we are going to compartmentalize kind of bureaucratic leadership, dealing with administration and, you know, time reporting and travel reimbursements and things like that. And somebody's going to do that really well. And then there's sort of intellectual leadership, where I feel like the intellectual leadership often in what you're involved with has been opened, as the word has been used, and you allow a lot of people, not you, but, you know, that the projects are structured in a way where a lot of different people can step in and provide that leadership. Is that intentional? Am I characterizing it correctly? Because I feel like that has been a model that I've seen a lot of, and it seems to work fairly well in this sort of transdisciplinary pursuit.
Well, I think there's a number of parts to that puzzle, and I think one recognition is the fact that there are elements of the research endeavor that need to be done, but they're a pain in the neck, and they don't lead to publishable articles, and they, may not lead to self-satisfaction by people who thought they were going to become academics. And we've moved, in some level, I took some of those activities on, but more to take them on to build an infrastructure, using your word, to operate large projects. And so the project manager, the outreach manager, the K-12 liaison, we've developed a variety of roles that are part of the intellectual endeavor in some way, because that's the knowledge we're trying to communicate and that trying to do, but also involve a lot of setting up activities, reaching out to the community, doing a variety of things that, in fact, we as academics weren't trained to do very well. And so I think one message of these projects has been that takes a fair amount of energy, and yet it's done best by people who really understand the intellectual mission as well. And that's where I think our early efforts were really distinct from what was going on, and I fear from what is maybe going on again. And that is the people who are in charge of school outreach or public relations or even, proposal development were engaged in the actual intellectual endeavor. Even if they may not have been the leaders, they were part of the group that was thinking about it and learning about it, so that there was a coherence in the way that you actually organize the project that fit together with the kind of intellectual issues you were pursuing, to hopefully more effectively get at them or more comprehensively treat them, or to weld together closer the research and the learning aspects. And I think a lot of the energy in Eurex and Nancy Grimm's subsequent projects also are devoted to how do we really get graduate student training in sync with large-scale interdisciplinary research when the degrees remain disciplinary, when the advisors remain disciplinary, yet we're talking big transdisciplinary assemblages. And we want to train people to be able to work in that milieu. And so sometimes this has come back together as well.
Chuck, thank you. Appreciate the time today and giving us your perspectives here. To the attendees, thanks for participating. And a reminder that tomorrow, same time, same place, same link, we have Professor Sybil Darable at University of Illinois Chicago, who's a civil engineer, who will speak with me about infrastructure for visible cities, which is a play on the book, The Invisible Cities, that is a wonderful book, which we'll talk about tomorrow. So with that, we'll sign off and hopefully see you all tomorrow.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks again, Chuck.
The Future Cities podcast is an outreach effort brought to you by the Urban Resilience to Extremes Sustainability Research Network, or UREX as we usually refer to it. To learn more about UREX, visit www.sustainability.asu.edu/urban-resilience. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at futurecitiespodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at futurecitiespod. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.